The reading's in two parts, John chapter 20, verses 1 to 10, and verses 24 to 29. The first one is on page 57 in these blue John's Gospel on your table. Now, on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene came to the tomb early, while it was still dark, and saw that the stone had been taken away from the tomb. So she ran and went to Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one whom Jesus loved, and said to them, "They have taken the Lord out of the tomb, and we do not know where they have laid him." So Peter went out with the other disciple, and they were going towards the tomb. Both of them were running together, but the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first. And stooping to look in, he saw the linen cloths lying there, but he did not go in. Then Simon Peter came, following him, and went into the tomb. He saw the linen cloths lying there, and the face cloth which had been on Jesus' head, not lying with the linen cloths, but folded up in a place by itself. Then the other disciple, who had reached the tomb first, also went in, and he saw and believed. For as yet they did not understand the scripture that he must rise from the dead. Then the disciples went back to their homes. And on page 59 from verse 24. Now Thomas, one of the 12, called the twin, was not with them when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, "We have seen the Lord." But he said to them, "Unless I see in his hands the mark of the nails and place my finger into the mark of the nails and place my hand into his side, I will never believe." 8 days later, his disciples were inside again, and Thomas was with them. Although the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here and see my hands, and put out your hand and place it in my side. Do not disbelieve, but believe." Thomas answered him, "My Lord and my God." Jesus said to him, "Have you believed because you have seen me? Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed."
Thank you very much for reading, and may I add my warm welcome to you. Glad you've been able to make it this lunchtime. It's good to see you here. And thank you for coming to think about this vital, vital subject of the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. Now, I guess none of us can have failed to have noticed the tearing down of the old Crédit Agricole building just across there on the Commercial Union Square. The building was constructed, you probably know, through being hung from the top, and therefore it has had to be deconstructed, if you've read the signs, from the bottom up, which leaves us with the 8 floors, or I think it may be 7 floors, still remaining, hung from the central lift shaft. It's an extraordinary sight, and some people have compared it to a vast game of Jenga on a scale that only the city could manage to invent. There was a time, I'm told, and this may be an urban myth, but I'm told that there was a time when, in spite of the deconstruction from the bottom up, there was still one office on the top floor in which the lights were on, the computers were on, pictures were still being hung around, and there was a guy sitting there working at his desk, even though the bottom 7 or 8 floors had gone. Now, I suspect it was the site office, But the person who told me about this office, still in existence, suspended in midair, as it were, told me the story as if the poor bloke was coming into work every day on the 16th floor, blissfully unaware on everything that was going on around him. And he said, well, of course, he's an underwriter or something like that. I can't remember. Whoever it was he was wanting to have a go at, he was that. But it struck me as being an interesting thought, doesn't it? The world had changed. There was a whole future being constructed, and yet there he was, coming into work day after day after day, as if nothing had happened. Now, our subject this afternoon is the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. And I wanted to see that the resurrection, if it happened, is a unique event that has radical implications for not only our own individual lives, but for the whole of creation. And therefore, to continue living as if it simply hasn't happened is to carry on living rather like that bloke working on the 14th floor while everything else has changed all around him. Really, I've just got two points. The first is this, that the resurrection shows that Jesus Christ alone is Lord of all life. And the second point is this, that the resurrection shows, if it happened, that Jesus Christ alone can give life. But before we get to those two points, they're such big points, I feel we must do something to do with the evidence for the resurrection. Because we need to know that this great claim is built, if you like, on really solid ground. And therefore, what I want to do is to start by looking at the evidence for the resurrection from this eyewitness account that we've got in front of us. I want us to see that the resurrection was unexpected, that it was carefully recorded, repeatedly predicted, that it's physical, logical, credible. All those things, and we'll run through them quickly as we look at the evidence. First of all, it was unexpected. One of the striking things that hits me every time I read the accounts, these independent accounts of the resurrection, is that his disciples didn't appear to expect it. You know, we sometimes hear, don't we, people speak as if, oh, the disciples just made it all up to make the resurrection fit with what they were already expecting. But when you read the independent accounts over and over again, the unexpected nature of the resurrection is what's stressed. So just have a look early on in our reading on page 57, at the bottom of the page there, chapter 20, and the very bottom line, verse 2, halfway through, Mary comes to the tomb, she sees it's empty, and then she says, they have taken the Lord out of the tomb, and we don't know where they've laid him. In other words, Mary sees the empty tomb and immediately assumes not that Jesus has risen, but the body has been taken away. Now, we find the same point underlined there in verse 9, at the end of that paragraph. As yet, they did not understand the scriptures that he must rise from the dead. So they weren't expecting it. And then we see the point underlined yet again in verse 13, just next paragraph, where Jesus says to the angels say to Mary, woman, why are you weeping? She said to them, they've taken away my Lord, and I don't know where they've laid him. In other words, she just wasn't expecting him to have risen from the dead. She knows he's dead, and she can't think what's happened to the body. Now, if we had time, I could take you to the other eyewitness accounts of the resurrection of Jesus Christ and show you exactly the same over and over and over again. They just weren't expecting it. So it is patently not the case that the disciples knew Jesus would rise and therefore made up a whole concoction of stuff in order to make it sound as if he did rise. Quite the opposite. With the death of Jesus Christ, who was nailed to a cross, crucified, and clearly dead, all was lost. They gave up hope. And it was only the resurrection appearances that convinced them. And again, Doubting Thomas, as he's known, I'm sure you've heard of Doubting Thomas over the page 59 there, is a case in point yet again. Unless I see his hands and the marks of the nail and the hole in his side, I will not believe. They weren't expecting it. It was unexpected. However, having become convinced, it's then carefully recorded. And I want us to note this, just how carefully this eyewitness material is put together. Because my friends down on Fleet Street, and I have some friends down on Fleet Street, lawyers, you know, and they tell me that whenever they read these accounts, they read as eyewitness material. So barristers who are used to dealing with this sort of stuff in court say this actually reads as if it was a person who was actually there. Just have a look, would you, at verses 3 to 8. Top of the page 58 there, first line right at the end. So, Peter went out with the other disciple and they were going towards the tomb. Both of them were running together, but the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first. And stooping to look in, he saw the linen cloths lying there, but he did not go in. Then Simon Peter came, following him, and went into the tomb. He saw the linen cloths lying there, and the face cloth which had been on Jesus' head, not lying with the linen cloths, but folded up in a place by itself. Then the other disciple, who'd reached the tomb first, also went in, and he saw and believed. They ran, they stooped, they saw. One didn't enter, the other did. There were the cloths, the face cloth was separate, folded up, the other entered, they believed. Now, as I say, over and over and over again, my legal friends tell me this just reads like eyewitness material. And there's another thing we have to say at this point, if we're going to be honest and thorough in our research, and that is this. If the gospel writers did make this up, they then invented a form of literature which was not found or invented anywhere else in the world for a further 1,500 years. Now, C.S. Lewis, you may or may not have come across, he was a boffin, a real intellectual. He held the chair of English literature in, I think he held it in Cambridge as well as Oxford, not both at the same time, he moved from one to the other. But anyway, he was a first-rate academic. And he gave a lecture to his students in the 1970s that went like this. I have been reading poems, romances, vision literature, legends, myths, all my life. I know what they're like. I know that not one of them is like this. Of this text, there are only two possible views. Either this is reportage, eyewitness material, or else some unknown writer, without known predecessors or successors, suddenly anticipated the whole technique of modern novelistic, realistic narrative. If it's untrue, that is, if it's made up, it must be narrative of that kind. And then he says, as only an Oxford academic could, the reader who doesn't see this has simply not learned to read. In other words, if you want to hold on to the idea that the disciples made it up, you have to believe that they invented the fictional historical novel 1,500 years before it appeared anywhere else in the world. That's quite a big thing for you to have to believe. The resurrection of Jesus then is unexpected. It is carefully recorded and actually repeatedly predicted. Though the disciples didn't believe it, actually it was repeatedly predicted by Jesus. And not only by Jesus, but actually running right the way through the first part of the Bible, the Old Testament, we find the resurrection of Jesus predicted in 2 Samuel, in Isaiah again, in Daniel, in the Psalms, in Hosea, and again and again and again. But the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus isn't just unexpected, carefully recorded, and predicted. I want to suggest that it is also a physical resurrection. It's logical that he rose, and credible. Physical. This is not simply a spiritual experience. You know, you sometimes hear people say, oh, well, they kind of saw a hallucination or a ghost or something like that. Just look at verse 20, would you, across the page. the first major paragraph. When he had said this, he showed them his hands and his side. Look down at verse 25. Thomas says to him, "Unless I see in his hands the mark of the nails and place my finger into the mark of the nails and place my hand into his side, I will never believe." And then verse 27, Jesus appears and says to Thomas, "Put your finger here, see my hands, put out your hand, place it into my side. Don't disbelieve, but believe." This is not a ghost. He's physical. And in Luke's gospel, he actually asks for some fish to eat and says, "Ghosts do not eat, have flesh and blood like I have." It's physical. It's logical. It's logical on two counts. You see, the authorities, that is the Jews and the Roman authorities, would have done anything to scotch the rumour that Jesus has risen from the dead. What is the one thing they would have done to scotch the rumour? If you'd wanted to scotch the rumour that Jesus has risen from the dead and put an end to this silly idea that was passing around, what would you have done? Produce the body. But they don't. Because they can't. Because he's alive. No one's able to produce the body. 500 people claim to have seen him risen. Of those 500, numerous are prepared to go to the most horrific death rather than deny that he's risen. You've got to ask yourself, if you're a logical person, what are you going to believe? But it's also theologically, if you don't mind me using that word, it's theologically logical. Because throughout his life, Jesus claimed that on the cross, when he died, he would carry God's judgment at sin. And God's judgment at human rebellion is death. Separation from God. Judgment. Now, if Jesus had paid God's judgment at sin, fully, completely, absolutely, what is the most logical thing to expect? Price paid? He rises. So it's logical, both because you can't produce the body, and second, theologically. It's also credible, that is physical, logical, credible. Credible because there were skeptics even then who didn't believe it and who were then persuaded when they saw the evidence. Now, Thomas, I love Thomas because he is, I mean, I hope you don't mind me saying this and I hope it doesn't offend you that you're not from this part of the world. He is the sort of quintessential skeptical, stubborn Yorkshireman. Okay, now look, if you are here from Yorkshire, don't take it personally. But you know, if you were filming Thomas, he would be Jeff Boycott, wouldn't he? Dug in, you're not going to budge him, however hard you try. And Thomas says, and I won't try the accent because then you really will murder me, but unless I see in his hands the marks of the nails and place my finger in the marks of the nails and place my hand in his side, I will never believe. What happens? 3 days later, there is Jesus. Thomas, put your hand here. Reach out your hand. Touch. And what does Thomas say? My Lord. My God. On Sunday the 21st of January this year, a hunter in Florida shot a ring-necked duck. Believing the duck to be dead, he left it in his fridge at home in Tallahassee. Next morning, his wife came to the fridge, she opened the door, and Perky, as she has become known, lifted her head and quacked. They rushed Perky to the local vet. I don't know what brought about this change. I mean, personally, I won't tell you what personally I would have done. But anyway, something brought it. They rushed Perky off to the local vet, where she underwent extensive surgery. Sadly, midway through the operation, Perky's heart stopped, and the vet and his assistant struggled to bring her back to life. She stopped breathing. They tapped her on the chest. They manipulated the beak. They gave her a little electric shock. And after a few minutes, the vet turned to the hunter and his wife and announced solemnly, "I'm so sorry. She's gone." At that point, Perky raised her head from the operating table, quacked, and started to flap her wings. Now that is a resuscitation. This is a resurrection. We're not saying Jesus just sort of nodded off on the cross, you know, and sort of somehow didn't feel very well, and then 3 days later, oh, whoops, you know, he came round again. No, he rose physically. It's logical because he's paid for the price of human rebellion and sin. It's credible. It was not expected. It was widely recorded. And it was certainly predicted, the resurrection. Now, my 2 points, and I'm going to give them very briefly. This means that Jesus Christ alone is Lord of all life. And this means that Jesus Christ alone can give life. Lord of all life. Thomas's response, just look at it in verse 28, would you? Thomas's response, Thomas calls it right. Thomas answered him, "My Lord, my God." All the way through the Bible, God promises that he will send his heavenly king who will establish his kingdom over which he will rule for eternity. It will be a perfect kingdom where everything that spoils this world is removed once and for all. His king will be judge of every single man and woman who has ever walked the earth. He will summon all to judgment. And those who trust in him, he will give a place in this heavenly kingdom. That's a very short summary of 66 books of the Bible. Jesus himself says, "As the Father raises the dead and gives them life, so also the Son gives life to whomever he will. The Father judges no one, but has entrusted all judgment to the Son." So that Jesus claims to be the Lord and Judge, God's eternal King, the one to whom everything that God has got planned for the future belongs. He comes to the earth. He dies for our rebellion against God. He rises. Thomas sees him, "My Lord, my God." The future belongs to Jesus. God's future belongs to Jesus. He is Lord of all life. In the early days of the deconstruction of that tower over there, just before it started being torn down, do you remember they had a great big demo in the hallway of what the new Leadenhall Tower was going to look like, a picture of the future? And you saw the, 850 floors or whatever it's going to be, and just what it's going to be like. Well, the resurrection of Jesus, if you like, gives us a snapshot of the future. This is what the future is. It belongs to Jesus Christ. He is Lord. He is Judge. Jesus is Lord of life. Jesus alone gives life. That is, Jesus is the only one who has actually died to carry God's judgment at everything that we have done wrong. Jesus has done that. And the resurrection proves that what he did worked. And therefore, as we come to Jesus Christ, we find that Jesus holds out to us the offer of forgiveness and free membership of God's eternal kingdom. And that's a thing that starts now. Jesus alone gives life. It begins today. It can start, on October, is it the 4th today? October the 4th at 13:25 or whatever the time is. As we accept Jesus Christ into our life, receive his forgiveness, and are reconnected with the God who holds the future, so we are given a place in God's future. Just look at one last verse with me, would you? And that is there at the bottom of page 58 and the bottom three lines, verse 17. Jesus said to Mary, "Don't cling to me. I've not yet ascended to the Father. Go to my brothers. Say to them, I am going to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God." So that as we come to Jesus, he enables us to call God Father, my Father, and to call Jesus Christ brother, and to be part of God's eternal kingdom forever. That's the offer. That's what's on the table. And let me speak personally for a moment. I didn't actually get started as Christian until I was an adult. And up to that point, I'd never realized that that was what was on the table, a relationship with the living God that begins now and stretches into eternity. Let me tell you that it changes the whole of life as you start to live this life with God your Creator and walk through this life day by day knowing God as my Father. Christianity is not about rules and regulations. It's not about ritual and rote. It's not about religion and rigmarole. It's about this relationship where I call God my Father. Well, my time is up. This is the life that Jesus is speaking about. He alone is Lord of life. He alone gives life. You won't find this offer anywhere else, in any religious system, anywhere in the world. Only Jesus offers it. Only Jesus has risen. Only Jesus died for sin. And you certainly won't find it with the Richard Dawkins or the Christopher Hitchens or the materialistic dream that our world offers. You won't find it there. Life with your Creator forever. I wonder what it would take to bring that guy down from the 14th floor. I mean, you know, if you felt you needed a mission to go and persuade him to come down from the 14th floor, what would it take? You'd want to go up to him and say, sort of slightly grab him gently by the lapels and say, or maybe it was a her, I don't know, grab them gently by and say, look, don't you realize, can't you see, you know, that the future has changed? There's been an event. You need to open your eyes and have a look. And what we're wanting to do as we look at this resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, where there's all that evidence, credible, logical, physical, unexpected, carefully recorded, clearly predicted. What we're wanting to do is say, look, can't you see? The future has changed. It belongs to Jesus Christ. You'll meet him as your judge. Come to him now, meet him as your friend and your Savior, and take a place in his everlasting kingdom. It's a great offer. Now, look, I'm happy to answer questions. We're going to have just a couple of minute break. If you've jotted down some questions, hand them in. I'll do my best to take as many as I can, and we will finish certainly by 10:50. Let's draw together if we may. I've got a handful of really excellent questions. I'd like to give them a reasonable bit of time. Can you do the William Hague impersonation again? Let me say ridiculous. Why was the resurrection unexpected when Jesus had explained that he would rise from the dead while he was alive? And you see that both in Mark's Gospel and all the other Gospels. Yeah, unexpected may not be... I said it was predicted, but it was unexpected by the disciples. And that's my point, that they should have expected it, but I think it's such a mind-blowing thing. You know, to have somebody who was dead, whose body ought to have started to decompose, to rise from the dead. It's so completely outside the sphere of our understanding. I mean, just to get a glimpse of it without being too macabre, you know, this evening when you go home, open the deep freeze or the fridge and pull out whatever, I mean, not if you're a vegetarian, if you have trouble with this, but to pull out something that is, you know, pull out a chicken or something like that and just think to yourself about the possibility of this thing coming back to life. So I think it was totally, although they had it explained, they just had not grasped it. And then the implications begin to dawn, how huge it is what has happened. That which has kind of gripped every human being who has ever lived, there's now a possibility of having it changed through Jesus Christ. And it's a monumental thing. Where is the evidence that Jesus wasn't resuscitated? Surely he could have been knocked out from the pain of crucifixion and come to 3 days later in the cool of the tomb. Well, let's just have a look at it in John's Gospel, shall we? So page 57 and verse 38, Jesus is buried. After these things, Joseph of Arimathea, who was a disciple of Jesus, but secretly for fear of the Jews, asked Pilate that he might take away the body of Jesus, and Pilate gave him permission. So he came and took away the body. Nicodemus also, who earlier had come to Jesus by night, came bringing a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 75 pounds in weight. So they took the body of Jesus, bound it in linen cloths, as is the burial custom, and in the place where he was crucified, there was a garden, a new tomb, and they laid him there. Now, it's important to realize what John's doing here. In Jewish law, you had to have two male witnesses to prove something. Nicodemus was called the teacher of Israel. He was, you know, big establishment figure. And Joseph of Arimathea, a wealthy man who was wealthy enough to have his own tomb. And so John takes these two key figures and says they were both there and they buried him dead. In addition to that, verse 34, just above, one of the soldiers pierced his side with a spear and at once there came out blood and water. Now, I am not a medic, okay? TCP is my solution to every single human ailment. If you've got a problem, I recommend TCP. But the medics tell me that when somebody is dead, one of the things that happens is the blood and the serum separate. And so, though John wouldn't have known it, he records certain evidence medically that Jesus was now dead because the blood and water flowed out from his side. That's a sure sign, the medics say, of death. Now, all of this, you have to begin to say, look, am I going to have to believe more incredible things to carry on believing that Jesus didn't rise from the dead, or less? I mean, it begins, the position of the person in the 14th floor begins to get increasingly untenable. Doesn't Jesus say in verse 17, my God? So Jesus isn't God, but just his son. Well, we're delving right into one of the biggest and most complex areas of the Christian faith. We have to say that Jesus claims to be God, behaves like God, and I would want to say demonstrably is God, but that there are three persons of the Godhead, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and that Jesus can speak to God the Father as God and address him like that when he's on earth. Now, we have to say that Jesus is God because he claimed to be God. We've got just time to flick back to chapter 8 and verse 58-59. Bottom of page 27, John chapter 8, verse 58. He was being questioned by the Jews, and he says, in answer to their question as to who he is, truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was, I am. Now, if you know anything from the Old Testament, you'll know that I am is God's name, Yahweh. And Jesus says, before Abraham was, I am. Now, the Jews understood what he was. Look at what they did. What did they do? They picked up stones to stone him. So they knew what he was claiming, to be nothing less than God the Son. God the Son. And this was a revolutionary moment as they had their understanding of the Godhead radically changed. God the Father, God the Son, God the Holy Spirit. Now, you will find in this world that there are some people that hold Jesus out to be a great prophet. Are you aware of that? There are some religions even that say Jesus is a great prophet. And in their holy books, they say Jesus is nothing less than a great prophet alongside Abraham and so on. If Jesus is a great prophet, then you need to come to terms with the fact that he claims to be nothing less than Yahweh, God. And then we have to make the next logical step. Either he is a liar, in which case my holy book is wrong, he's not a great prophet, or he is who he says he is, in which case I must follow what my holy book says, take him seriously, and turn and worship him. Okay, important, just an important little point. No more time for questions. Let me mention Christianity Explored. It's a 7-week opportunity to ask your questions. And if you see that little white slip there on your table, think about coming and joining us for Christianity. There's so many questions we haven't had time for. Think about coming and following this through with Christianity Explored. And then you will also see we're starting a new series next Tuesday and Thursday, RSVP. And we're just going to be doing similar to what we've done today, taking short passages of Luke's Gospel and having a look at them. Thank you very much for coming, and I hope we'll see you again.